It's time to take a second look at the news on WMRA over the last week. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. We'll pack a lot into the next half hour, including this week's Our Island Universe, a look at the changing definition of homelessness that is almost as difficult to figure out as the problem itself, a tour down the Rivanna River near Charlottesville, and what one local NAACP leader is saying about race, privilege, and protest. But first, way back in the days before supermarkets, big box stores, and the internet, many of us, especially folks in rural areas, got supplies from the local general store. They've mostly disappeared, but one general store in the town of Middlebrook in Augusta County is not only surviving, it's thriving. WMRA's Jesse Nadler paid a visit and has this report.
It's an unseasonably cold afternoon in April, and eight or so volunteers have gathered together to give the Little Wood Middlebrook General Store a fresh coat of white paint, all donated by Sherwin-Williams in Lexington. It'll take a long time for the paint to dry. It's 42 degrees outside, but the volunteers don't seem to mind.
I think we expected a warmer day. You know, we primed it last week, and it was a much warmer day.
Stanley Bright, retired, is board chairman of the Middlebrook General Store. The store has been serving farmers in this corner of Augusta County in some form or fashion since 1901. This was the place where locals could come and stock up on everything from milk to nails to fabric to juicy gossip. It was the heartbeat of this little village. But in recent years, the store, like a lot of things, couldn't compete with box store culture. It finally shut down for good in 2009. Middlebrook, population just over 200, had lost its hub. Villagers felt it.
There was a lot of feeling in the community that it would be nice to have the store open again. It would be good for the community.
Stanley is among 125 investor members, including a bunch of those who came out to paint, who each invested anywhere from $25 on up to raise $125,000 to buy the building and reopen it as a store in 2011.
Even though it's no gold mine, it's not like owning an oil well or anything close to that, but I think it has been good for the community, and I think most of the people in the community enjoy it, as evidenced by the fact that, you know, we've had these work days like today where people have turned out to paint the store and stuff.
Middlebrook General Store may no longer sell fabric or nails, but it sells staple grocery items, including bread, beer, salad dressing, plus T-shirts, freshly made pizzas, Virginia-made products like potato chips and maple syrup. The front window displays curios such as a beige rotary dial telephone. Remember those? A barrel of complimentary peanuts is just inside the front door. The store also houses a cafe, which bustles at lunchtime. One of the diners is Helen Jarvis.
This is my first time to come for a meal, but I've lived in Middlebrook since 1947.
Her husband is here every morning for the ad hoc men's meeting. What do they talk about at the men's meeting?
I have no idea. Gossip. That's what they do. They catch up on the gossip when they're here.
Some things never change. Henley Gabeau is another investor member and secretary of the board.
Lately, I've started calling it the Cheers of Virginia Route 252 because Ann Schultz and her family manage it. And they are so happy and smiles and positive. And Ann likes to cook, so the food is good. It's just a great atmosphere in here. And it's Cheers without the alcohol.
For listeners under a certain age, Cheers is a popular television show from the 80s about a tight-knit tavern in Boston. Store manager Ann Schultz was slammed with lunch orders in the tiny, no-frills kitchen. Diners, including Rockbridge County resident Becca Shad, had nice things to say about the menu.
And the food's great. It's all homemade.
Middlebrook General turns a small profit, aided by the efforts and contributions of so many community members.
There was a fella who was a longtime farmer in this area and very well respected. A lot of people liked him, and he died a while ago. And his widow sent us a very nice letter saying how much she had appreciated the fact that the store was open, and when his health was declining, this was a place where her husband could could come. It sort of gave them something to do, you know. So when you get a letter like that, why, it makes the whole thing worthwhile.
For WMRA News, I'm Jesse Nadler.
In January, the government's new definition of chronically homeless took effect. Officials say this new definition, which has been years in the making, will actually aid in eliminating chronic homelessness by 2017, 2 years after an earlier deadline for that same goal. WMRA's Christopher Clymer-Kurtz reports that when it comes to defining chronic homelessness, though, little seems definite.
Wake up with animals, things crawling on you or whatnot, so learn to wrap up in plastic and all that. Learn to sleep up off the ground if you can.
Mark Carity's decade-long homelessness ended recently thanks to vigorous community efforts to help him and others in similar situations.
There were too many issues that couldn't be resolved, so who would have expected?
Just as Carity faced many uncertainties as a homeless person, ambiguity is woven through much of the discussion about homelessness as well.
This isn't black and white. This is really gray.
That's Lisa Wolf, Regional Public Affairs Officer in the Office of Field Policy and Management. She's talking about the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development's new definition of chronically homeless in the context of the Obama administration's plan to prevent and end homelessness, which is touted as the nation's first strategy to do so.
So when you have a major concerted first-time effort like this, it's really important for everyone to be on the same page in terms of what the various types or classifications of homelessness are.
Basically, the new definition says that to be considered chronically homeless, a person must have a disability. That was in the earlier definition, too. But goes on to clarify the amount of time a person must be homeless during the last 3 years, 12 months continuously, or 12 months cumulatively over at least four separate occasions, and requires that time to be documented.
If you're unable to document it, then it's difficult for them to gain access into those types of housing options.
Michael Wong has been executive director of the Harrisonburg Redevelopment and Housing Authority since 2001. He understands that the new definition may help allocate resources to those most in need, but was surprised by its time requirement severity. The new definition has been in effect now for only a few months, but Wong predicts that it will have an impact in the future when homeless people try to access permanent housing with supportive services. Documenting that someone meets the criteria to fit the definition is not exactly straightforward. Consider this scenario, focusing on the time requirement. Under the new definition, if someone is homeless on four different episodes for 3 months each time, that's the required 12 months, they would be considered chronically homeless. However, if that same person would have been homeless on only three different occasions, even though they were each for, say, 8 months, that's a cumulative total of 24 months, they would not qualify because even though that person would have been on the street twice as long, it was only over three episodes.
Am I confused or does that just not make any sense?
I think you and I are pretty reasonably smart guys, but we're having a hard time pinning this down ourselves.
Shannon Porter is executive director of Mercy House in Harrisonburg. He says that nomenclature matters.
My definition of most vulnerable may include other factors beyond just this limited definition.
It turns out that what determines an episode of homelessness is not the homelessness, but the not homelessness. That is, a person's breaks from homelessness. HUD's definition provides some flexibility because those breaks can be documented by the self-report of the individual seeking assistance. The indefinite nature of discussion about homelessness is further apparent in a HUD claim about homelessness in Virginia.
You know, as you know, Virginia was the first state in the nation to effectively end veteran homelessness.
So there are no homeless veterans in Virginia?
So what we acknowledge with ending homelessness in any of these areas, that as of last November, we declared that simply because Virginia has put a system in place so that when a veteran is identified, that individual will not be homeless for long, meaning there is now a system in place to quickly react.
Official definitions about homelessness can also exclude people who might otherwise be considered homeless. Couch surfers and people who park their RVs at friends' houses or campgrounds don't necessarily count under any HUD definition of homelessness. But as Wong maintains,
if you call a duck, and it quacks because it's a duck, it's pretty much a duck. They're pretty much homeless.
Definitions aside, Wong says that thanks to a partnership between a number of different service providers and community organizations in Harrisonburg and Rockingham County, some previously homeless people have obtained permanent supportive housing in the new Commerce Village, a $4.2 million 30-unit project serving veterans and other chronically homeless individuals in Harrisonburg. Veteran Mark Carity is one of those people. He's still getting used to his new normal.
I was having muscle strain, and I couldn't figure out what it was. Then I realized it was from getting up in and out of a bed. I hadn't used those muscles in so long they'd atrophied.
For WMRA News, I'm Christopher Clymer-Kurtz.
If you've had trouble finding an outfitter to take a trip on the Rivanna River near Charlottesville, one local couple has launched a business to fill that gap and help explorers take advantage of the physical and aesthetic features the river offers. WMRA's Britt Moore took a trip down the river and filed this report.
For a couple who's always found themselves enjoying nature and being on the water, Gabe and Sonia Silver are living the dream.
Keep paddling. Yep. There you go.
Navigating the currents on the Rivanna, that's life for this young Charlottesville couple on any given day.
We both grew up in this area. We grew up nearby and grew up playing outside a lot.
On the perfect spring day in May, I stepped into a canoe as the Silvers led me on an hour and a half tour down the Rivanna.
The more vertical you get with the paddle, the more the stronger your stroke is.
A glimpse into their world. The ride for a not-so-in-touch-with-nature kind of girl, well, it left me wanting more.
There's all these big turtles basking in the sun on these logs, and they keep, that's the little splashes we're hearing is that they see our canoe.
It's the feeling, the swishing of the water in the background that puts Gabe and Sonia Silver at ease.
It's right in our backyard. And the fact that you can have that experience, that wonderful, unique, calming time in nature, and, you know, you drove 10 minutes from your house, or you rode your bike down here, or you walked from your house. I mean, and you get on the river for an hour or two.
It's an experience they'd like everyone living in and around Charlottesville to have.
I think rivers have been places that were really important to the economy early on in terms of transportation. So, like, Charlottesville wouldn't be here if it weren't for the Rivanna. And Jefferson wouldn't have built Monticello where he did if it weren't for the Rivanna.
The Charlottesville couple has launched a new outfitting business, Rivanna River Company.
But a lot of people who have moved here from other places are always surprised that there's not a paddling outfitter here in town. Because, like, well, Charlottesville's an outdoorsy place, and maybe the place they lived before had some similarities to Charlottesville. And they're like, yeah, I'll just find the place I can rent a kayak.
But until now, finding that place has been difficult. The Silver's operation is a one-stop shop for people who want to experience the Rivanna River but don't know where to start.
It's a big park that if people know how to access, which part of which for a lot of people is an outfitter where they can rent equipment or have a guide, then it becomes an amenity for more people.
The Silvers are providing greater access to a piece of nature they believe is underutilized.
Just one trip a year. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Spend like 2 hours on the river every summer and just know your geography. You know, I mean, it's so, the way rivers cut through the terrain, it's just so fundamental to geography. And Charlottesville is here along the banks of a river for a reason.
In addition to outfitting river goers, the company also offers guided tours, a sort of moving history lesson where Gabe and Sonia will share stories and facts about the area often overshadowed by the more popular destinations.
Jefferson had the vision that he could have a port in Monticello that would basically be an indirect connection to ocean-going vessels that would go to Europe and back. The longer trips that would probably be our typical guided trip, you'll go through where you can actually physically see some of the dams and the locks and the canal system that was in place at that time.
The couple hopes to encourage people to put down the cell phones.
Giving people a place to just really have quality time together.
And really take it all in.
Someone who in Charlottesville doesn't know much or anything about the Rivanna and they get out on it, they're going to have just a slightly different appreciation of where they live, and potentially it can become a place you like to go a lot.
For WMRA News, I'm Britt Moore.
Last Sunday evening, about 30 people gathered at a church in Charlottesville to hear local NAACP leader Dr. Rick Turner speak about racial discrimination. WMRA's Jordy Yeager was there and has this report.
As president of the Albemarle Charlottesville branch of the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, Dr. Turner spoke to a mixed audience at Thomas Jefferson Memorial Church. The church's lead minister, Reverend Eric Wickstrom, asked how he, as a white man with white privilege, could help fight racial discrimination.
The most important thing is to show up. to show up and to voice your opinion. You'll be listened to because you have that kind of power. You have always had those kind of benefits. Mm-hmm. But it's not benefiting the nation. With all the power that you have, we want you to do something for it, for the nation.
Turner has also called for more scrutiny of law enforcement, specifically looking at the Charlottesville Police Department's stop and frisk data, which has shown that black residents are as much as three times as likely to be stopped by police as white residents.
I believe that more whites and more blacks will stand up and protest the police in these communities. You can't stop mass number of people from standing up, from peacefully standing up. You can't stop them.
Turner sat on the committee that considered candidates for Charlottesville's next police chief. On May 23rd, former Lexington Police Chief Al Thomas takes over Charlottesville's department as its first African-American chief. Turner called Thomas, quote, probably the most engaging, smart, respectful man that I ever met. For WMRA News, I'm Jordy Yeager.
When members of the General Assembly convened in January, they were considering more than a dozen bills aimed at cracking down on the car title lending industry. All of those efforts were scrapped, though, when lawmakers decided against passing legislation and instead asked the state regulator to take action. Now, Virginia Public Radio's Michael Pope has new campaign finance numbers that show what was really happening behind the scenes.
In the week before the General Assembly session began, title lenders gave $35,000 in campaign contributions to political action committees. And that's even though the election had come and gone. Like many businesses, title lenders make a habit of giving campaign contributions after the election, but before the session, when they're legally prohibited from giving.
They serve a very useful purpose for the business because it reminds people right at the start of the session who their friends are.
That's Stephen Farnsworth at the University of Mary Washington.
The coalition of people to block regulation may include some Democrats and some Republicans, and that's why they are equal opportunity givers. Some money goes to Democrats and some to Republicans.
Frank Schaffroth at George Mason University says title loan businesses are placing a very safe bet.
If you're a gambler, the odds are better for you, right? If you make your contributions before the election, your candidate might lose.
But Schaffroth says the conviction of former Governor Bob McDonnell for selling his influence to a wealthy benefactor, that's changed how people think about the relationship between money and power.
There's been a little nervousness, I think, in Richmond about taking campaign contributions that could be tied to some sort of official action.
Take, for example, the $15,000 contribution Loan Max gave to the Senate Democratic Caucus the day before session began. A few days later, the Senate Democratic leader brokered a deal that involved two of the state's leading car title lenders voluntarily agreeing to stop offering multiple kinds of loans. That deal ended up torpedoing all the reform bills.
It's impossible to say that there was a quid pro quo. I mean, you just can't say that.
That's Quentin Kidd at Christopher Newport University.
But it is possible to say that there was an effort on Loan Max's part to gain access to elected officials so that their case could be heard.
Loan Max certainly got a hearing from Senate Democratic leader Dick Saslaw. He's the one who negotiated that deal involving the voluntary agreement with two of the three car title lenders authorized to offer consumer finance loans. Loan Max was not part of that deal, even though the company currently holds a license to offer multiple kinds of loans at one location in Alexandria. Saslaw says Loan Max isn't the problem.
Loan Max doesn't do that business. They don't do it in the same facility. They were the ones that called and alerted me to what was going on.
Yeah, well, they have a license to do it. And
they don't do it. End of discussion.
State regulators refuse to release documents from Loan Max detailing how many consumer finance loans it issues each year, and regulators aren't subject to the state's public records law. So that actually may be the end of that discussion. But federal officials in Washington are having a different kind of discussion about these kinds of loans, and leaders at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau may be on the verge of issuing a new rule. That rule could radically change the business model for these companies. It would force lenders to prove borrowers can pay back loans before any money changes hands, and before people get trapped in a cycle of debt they can't get out of. I'm Michael Pope.
I'm Chanel Varani, and this is Our Island Universe. Perhaps the most exciting area in astrophysics today is that of exobiology, finding life beyond Earth and the processes that govern it. But what's life? How will we know we've found it? There are more than 20,000 genes that make up a typical human body. These genes carry out various biological functions. A hallmark of life, however, is the ability to reproduce. For that function, how many genes are necessary for life? In a clever landmark study, biologists investigated the genome of a bacteria. In particular, they reverse engineered the bacterium to see if they could find a minimum number of genes essential for life. What they discovered is shocking. Only 473 genes, about half the total, are needed. Moreover, of these 473 genes, 149, nearly a third of this minimum set, are of unknown function. This means that we don't even know what these genes do. This simple experiment is suggesting the presence of undiscovered functions that are essential for life. DNA is the software of life. While we scour the solar system and the galaxy looking for it, scientists are in the lab investigating basic questions about life and what it consists of. I am Chanel Barani, director of the John C. Wells Planetarium at James Madison University.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, the Just Pax Fund, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. If you'd like to learn more about how we fund our news and how you can help, go to WMRA.org, mouse over News, then click on News and Information Fund. Find all of our stories from the newsroom, the website, too. Be sure to click like on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio. And follow me on Twitter at WMRA News to get the latest on our coverage. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director and Morning Edition host. I will talk to you in the morning. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.